Okay, so welcome to Sutta class for this afternoon. We're going to be looking at Anathapindika Ovada Sutta, the discourse on advice to Anathapindika. Majjhima Nikaya number 143, this being the first sutta of the last chapter of the Majjhima Nikaya, the first out of the last 10. And this particular sutta having a somewhat extensive list of parallels. Although when you look more closely, the list of parallels is mostly made up of semi-parallels rather than full parallels. In the Chinese we have one version in the Ekotarika Agama of the possibly Mahasanghika school, and we don't find a version in the Madhyama Agama. So there's no versions in the Chinese parallel to the current sutta, parallel collection to the current collection, and a few partial parallels in Pali. So these are suttas that are similar or deal with similar circumstances. And the earlier edition of the comparative tables by Akanuma lists a certain sutta in the Majjhima Agama 28 as a parallel, but this seems to be a mistake, as it's similar to another sutta in the Pali which is talking about Sariputta's instructions to Anathapindika, where Anathapindika recovered rather than dying. Okay, so let's have a look at the sutta. One of the main unique points about the sutta is that it records Anathapindika's somewhat surprising response to receiving a deathbed teaching. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now, on that occasion, the household of Anathapindika was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. Then he addressed a certain man thus, saying, "Come, good man, go to the Blessed One, pay homage in my feet with your head at his feet, and say, 'Venerable Sir, the household of Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill.' He pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet. And then go to the Venerable Sariputta, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, 'Venerable Sir, the household of Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at Venerable Sariputta's feet.'" And say, "It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the household of Anathapindika out of compassion." So already somewhat interesting in the introduction. So we have here Anathapindika who who was the greatest disciple, supporter of the Buddha and the Sangha, somebody who'd been extraordinarily generous for many years.
The greatest male
disciple. Thank you for the correction. Yes. And here he is suffering, and where we learn that he's actually dying. And asked someone to go and pay respects to the Buddha and to Sariputta. But curiously enough, he doesn't say, "Oh, may the Buddha come and see me when in my sickness." So maybe even he doesn't merit a visit from the Buddha. And if he doesn't get one, then who does? I wonder.
Maybe that's after the Buddha passed away.
No, Sariputta passed away first. Well, he just told his friend to go and pay respects to him, so he must have been there. Yeah.
Did he get two different men or the same men to go land and Sariputta, or did he get two different men?
I think it's the same one, yeah. Anyway, okay, here's a brief bio of Anathapindika. He was a banker, or seti. Seti means a millionaire, but it's fair enough these days. Most millionaires are bankers. Who became famous because of the unparalleled generosity to the Buddha. His first meeting with Buddha was given during the first year after the enlightenment in Rajagaha, story given in the Vinaya, where an Atabindika had come on business. His wife was the sister of the Seti, how would you translate that? The Seti of Rajagaha, the magnate. Perhaps magnate might be good, the local magnate of Rajagaha. It's not a word you hear these days, but there you go. And when he arrived, he found the Seti preparing a meal for the Buddha and his monks on so splendid a scale that he thought that a wedding was in progress or that the king had been invited. On learning the truth, he became eager to visit the Buddha and did so very early the next morning. He was so excited by the thought of the visit that he got up three times during the night. When at last he started out for the Sitavana, the cool grove, the road was quite dark, but a friendly yakha, Sivaka, sped him on with words of encouragement. By force of his piety, the darkness vanished. The Buddha was staying in the Sitavana, and when Anathapindika reached there, spirits opened the door for him. He found the Buddha walking up and down, meditating in the cool air of the early dawn. The Buddha greeted him and talked to him on various aspects of the Dhamma. Anathapindika was immediately converted and became a stream enterer. He invited the Buddha to a meal the next day, providing everything himself, although the Seti, the mayor of Rajagaha, and King Bibisara asked to be allowed to help. After the meal, he asked the Buddha to spend the rainy season at Savatthi, and the Buddha accepted, saying, "The Tathagatas, O householder, take pleasure in solitude." "I understand, O Blessed One, I understand," was the reply. So then he went back to Savatthi, giving gifts and so on along the way. And then when he arrived in Savatthi, he looked for a quiet spot. And then he bought a park belonging to Prince Jeta, and he erected on there the famous Jetavana, Jeta's monastery. And the result of this and numerous other benefactions in the cause of the Sasana, he became to be recognized as the chief of almsgivers. Anathapindika's personal name was Sudatta, but he always was called Anathapindika, the feeder of the poor. He was so he fed 100 monks in his house daily, in addition to meals provided for guests, people of the village, invalids, and so on. 500 seats were always ready in his house for any guests who might come. So his son wasn't particularly pious, but the daughters were very much so. Anathapindika is mentioned in a lot of Jataka stories and so on, which I won't go into detail. Backgrounds. If you want to look at the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names, you can see more of the details on Anathapindika. Okay, so that's enough background. Yes, sir, the man replied. He went to the Buddha, paid homage to him, and then went to the Sariputta, and then paid homage to him, and then invited him to Anathapindika's house. So in a Sariputta dressed, taking his bowl and robe, and went to the house of Anathapindika and said, "I hope you're getting well, householder. I hope you're comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding and not their increase is apparent. Venerable Sariputta, I'm not getting well. I'm not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. Just as if a strong man were splitting open my head with a sharp sword, so too violent winds cut through my head. Just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so too there are violent pains in my head. Just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly. Just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals, so too there is a violent burning in my body. I'm not getting well. I'm not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. So he's fairly straightforward about about his condition. So Sariputta replies, then householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the eye, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the eye. Thus you shall train. I will not cling to the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the mind. That you will train. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to forms, sounds, smells, flavors and touches. I will not cling to mind objects, and my consciousness will not be dependent on mind objects. You should train thus. I will not cling to eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on mind consciousness. Somewhat curious little way of putting things, but anyway. Go on, yeah. What it means will probably become apparent in just a moment, okay? I think. But if it doesn't, then ask the question again. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact. And my consciousness will not be dependent on mind contact. Thus you should train. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to feeling born of eye contact or other forms of contact. I will not cling to the earth element. I will not cling to the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element. I shall not cling to the consciousness element, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the consciousness element. Thus you should train. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to material form, feelings, perception, sankharas, activities, and consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on consciousness. Because this being the five aggregates. Householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, base of nothingness. I will not cling to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And my consciousness will not be dependent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception. You should train yourself thus. I will not cling to this world, and my consciousness will not be dependent on this world. I will not cling to the world beyond, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the world beyond. Thus you should train. Householder, you should train yourself thus. I will not cling to what is seen or heard or sensed or cognized or encountered. It's not sensed, seen or heard or thought or cognized, encountered, sought after and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. Thus you should train. When this was heard, the householder in Atapindika wept and shed tears. Sure. Which paragraph? The weeping and shedding tears one? Which paragraph? The one with the sensed in it. Yampi diktang sutang mutang vinyatang patang pariyesitang anupariyesitang anucharitang manasa. So whatever is seen, heard, mutang means thought. Whatever has been thought. Yeah. Vinyatang, cognized. Patang, whatever's been attained. Yeah, so it probably turns to meditation attainments. Pariyesitang, anupariyesitang, anucharitang. So whatever's been explored and thought out with the mind, so I think it's talking about like, I'm not going to be attached even like to ideas and concepts, things that I've, been over with my mind or any kind of fantasies or ideas or anything like that. So it's fairly comprehensive. Okay. So we'll come on to Anatta Pindika's response a bit later, but I'll just go over that a little bit over that teaching, because there are some things in the parallels which clarify certain rather curious aspects of that particular teaching. Okay, so to have a look at the parallels. The first part of the sutta has a parallel in the Sangyukta Agama. So just to have a look once more at the table of parallels, which is here. Okay, so this is a complete one, the partial parallels. So one minor difference in this story, the background story, is that according to the Sanyukta Agama and Ekotarika Agama versions, these two versions here, there was no invitation from Anatta Pindika. According to the Sangyukta Agama, Sariputta had simply heard about the sick condition of Anatta Pindika, whereas according to the Ekotarika Agama, he knew about it because of his divine eye, his psychic powers. The Anatta Pindika Sutta reports that when he arrived, Anatta Pindika described his deteriorating situation with a series of similes. However, according to the Ekotarika Agama version, he merely said that his condition was getting worse without all of the elaborate similes. All of the versions agree that Sariputta instructed Anatta Pindika on the development of detachment towards the various aspects of experience. In all versions, these instructions take up the six objects of the senses, encouraging Anatta Pindika to avoid clinging to them and not let his consciousness become dependent on them. While the Majjhima Nikaya version simply speaks of consciousness becoming dependent on the senses or their objects, the Sangyukta Agama version specifies that such dependence takes place through the arising of desire and lust. The Anatta Pindika Sutta stands alone in also applying the instructions to the six types of consciousness, the six types of contact, and the six types of feeling that arise based on them. So Analio has a table here which gives a lot more details. I'll just kind of summarize the table here. So according to most of the other versions, or the other two versions, we have the recollection for the six sense organs, eye, ear, nose, and so on, and then the six sense objects, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, for the six elements, earth, wind, fire, and so on, and for the five aggregates. Form, feeling, perception, activities, and consciousness. That's the Sangyukta Agama version. The Ekotarika Agama, the second version in Chinese, adds on to that, as well as those ones. It also has three recollections, which are Pindika says what three recollections they are. Presumably, yeah. Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, it's in the footnote there, yeah. So that's a recollection of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, which is quite, I mean, it's quite a common recommendation to someone on their deathbed, to sort of give them confidence and so on. Well, yeah, exactly. Presumably, it's to recollect. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of okay. He just taught the recollection. He didn't say don't cling to it. He just taught the recollection. And this also adds the dependent origination. Oops. Sure. So that's the second Chinese version. So this is the SA version. This is the EA version. I found all the details in an earlier study, so you don't need to write it down or whatever. It's all here. And so the main point of this is to then to see that in the Pali version we have quite an extended list going well beyond those, and as we've just heard, we have those ones. We also have the six sense objects and the six kinds of consciousness. Six consciousness, and then the six contacts. Six contacts, and the six feelings, and so on and so forth. And then six elements, five aggregates, and then the six feelings, and then the four immaterial attainments, this world and the next world. Next world, and what is seen, heard, etc. So anyway, a lot of things added to that in the Pali. So clearly the Pali has been subject to elaboration there. The other ones more or less similar, but you know, the topics are still quite closely related, and these teachings on the six senses and six sense organs, and so on. Often found in either more elaborate or less elaborate forms, and also very closely related to the teaching on dependent origination. So even though there's some difference in the detail there, there's no major difference in the actual sense of the topic. I'll just go on with the comparative study before we see if that's answered our questions that we had. So the Akotarika Agama versions do not mention the senses, but only their objects. Later, it doesn't mention the sense organs, so it doesn't know that one. However, later in the discourse, it takes up the senses for a more detailed treatment, explaining that when a sense arises, one does not know from where it comes, when it ceases, and one doesn't know where it goes. The Akotarika Agama discourse continues by highlighting that all things manifest by way of dependent arising, and then gives the 12 links. The Sangyukta Agama version agrees with the Majjhima Nikaya account in examining six elements and five aggregates. These are not found in the Akotarika Agama version, which however agrees with the Majjhima Nikaya discourse in taking up this world and the next world. And the six sense objects also, that should be in there. Missed that out before. Six elements. Oops. No, hang on. This is. I didn't complete this. So this is this world. Next world. And craving. Okay. I like it. Okay. The Majjhima Nikaya version stands alone in also not taking up the four immaterial attainments and what is seen, heard, thought and cognized as experiences in regard to which an Atipindika should avoid clinging and dependencies. All of them didn't. Only the Pali did. Yeah. The parallels report that at the end of the Thariputta's instruction, an Atipindika was in tears, as in spite of his devoted service, he had never received such an instruction. Now, I won't go on to that. I'll come back to that in a moment. And Alia has a footnote here which is also quite pertinent. He says that the reference to the four immaterial attainments is to some extent quite puzzling, as the way other discourses depict an Atipindika does not give any indication that he would have been a meditator of such proficiency as to be capable of entering such the immaterial attainments. So that is, I think, fair enough. There was another comment that he made here that I read earlier that I'm just not finding at the moment. That I think answered the question that we had earlier. No, about the consciousness and how consciousness is dependent on consciousness. Yeah, and what that meant is that kind of referring to different forms of consciousness and so on. Anyway, the basic answer to the question was that if you look at most of the occasions where it's talking about this, my consciousness will not be dependent on this kind of consciousness, then actually most of those passages don't appear in the parallel versions. So sometimes what happens is that in the suttas is that you have a like a particular, the teaching will be phrased in a particular way with regards to say in this we have various sets of dhammas. So we have the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and these are things which should all be investigated with insight and to be let go of. So we see the eye as impermanent, we see the ear as impermanent, and so on and so forth. Investigate them and let them go, and don't let your mind be dependent on that. So this is that statement that you should not let your vijnana be nisitam. Don't let your consciousness be dependent on that. So basically it's a statement saying you should let go of them. But what can happen sometimes when the suttas are being passed down is that those things can be expanded or contracted according to the vagaries of the oral tradition, so that a certain a passage which might have made sense in the original context then perhaps get it supplied in another situation where it doesn't make sense quite so well. So I think that's what's tending to happen here in the use of the word vijnana or consciousness, is that it's actually somewhat unusual to use the word don't let your consciousness be dependent on those things in that way. Normally it just says something like you shouldn't grasp at it or shouldn't be attached to it or something like that. But in this case, the important point here, as far as understanding the suttas and understanding the Dhamma, is what vijnana means and why is vijnana being used in this particular case. So why, when the Buddha is teaching to an Atapindika, doesn't he say just, you know, see the eye as impermanent, let go of it and don't be attached to it? Why does he say don't let your consciousness be dependent on that? Okay? And that's the unusual phrasing in this particular sutta, and so we have to understand why that is, why it's taught in that way in this particular case. So who's going to tell me?
I don't know for sure, but I would guess because of it being his death bed, there's hope that as he passes away, he will pass into final nirvana. I think he was at the third stage at that point.
I think he is a stream enterer.
Just a stream enterer.
I think so, yeah.
But if his consciousness isn't dependent on anything, then there would be nothing to hold him to any material world. Yep. He would just into
that
nirvana. That is my...
Yeah. It certainly seems that Sariputta was kind of reaching for that, doesn't it? Yeah? He's giving him these kind of really kind of just take no prisoners kind of teachings, you know? And I think there is something to that, yeah.
And also, we have those stories where Mata's trying to find where a consciousness has been born.
Right.
And he can't.
Yeah.
Because the person is fully enlightened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I agree. I think that's also the reason is that the term vijnana, we translate as consciousness, but is used specifically or used very, very commonly in the sense of being of rebirth. Right? So it's your consciousness is what takes rebirth. So and then because he's just about to die, then basically he's saying, you know, if your consciousness becomes attached to those things, then you're going to get reborn. So let go, don't let your consciousness be dependent on any of those things. Yeah. Yeah, so it's na. And then whatever it is, manosampasaja vedna, mind, a contact, a feeling born of mind contact, nisitam, vinyanam bhavisati, my mind will not, my consciousness will not be dependent on that thing.
But it could mean in the, not take rebirth dependent on that thing.
Right. In fact, that's basically what I think it means. Yeah, my mind will not take, my consciousness will not take rebirth dependent on that thing. Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't quite catch the word
stream something. Oh, stream enterer. Stream enterer is someone on the first stage of enlightenment. Okay. So. Maybe not. Yeah, maybe, but that's not quite the issue here. The point is that the four stages of enlightenment according to Buddhism, and at the first stage of enlightenment, then someone has let go of certain kinds of fetters or defilements or attachments or whatever, but they still have others left, so they'll still get reborn. They won't get reborn in a bad way. They'll only take a good rebirth, but still. Why get reborn when you don't have to? So it seems that's why Sariputta is giving quite an advanced teaching to him on his deathbed, to really sort of make him look at some of those deeper aspects of Dhamma which he maybe hasn't been looking at up to there. Yeah, so he can let go at a deeper level. Yeah, seven times at most, yeah.
Seven-ish. We think it's probably
seven-ish
rather than like
an absolute and useful law of the universe. Yeah, I would guess so, yeah. Yep. Are you going to discuss how one make actually does it? make one, make your consciousness not dependent on like one. Oh, you just do it. Yeah, just let go and then it's just not. Yeah. Yeah, and that appendicate goes, oh yeah, sure, no problems. Well, here it's being taught as a, he's saying, therefore householder, you should, this is how you should train yourself. And then he's giving him this series of reflections. So it's like he's giving him some meditation reflections to be using while he's lying there on his deathbed, yeah? And so he can actually go through them as a reflection. So my mind won't be attached to the eye, my mind won't be attached to my ear, my mind won't be attached to... And so you can actually just use that as the way it's taught here, is just as a reflection. Yeah? Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, consciousness not being attached to consciousness. Sorry, yes. Where are we? Yeah, it comes up in a couple of places. So here in the context of six elements, na vinyana dhatum nachame vinyana dhatu nisitang vinyanang bhavisati. So I will not let my consciousness be dependent on the consciousness element. Right. And then here in the context of the five khandhas, I will not let my consciousness be dependent on consciousness in the five khandhas.
It's
not a normal idiom in the suttas to say I won't let my consciousness be dependent on consciousness. And I think probably the original formulation was used in the context of the six senses and the six sense objects, saying my consciousness will not be dependent on those things. And then it kind of got extended to those other categories more or less just by a reciter's error, probably. So sometimes you just have to be aware of these things, because sometimes you can... sometimes we can have a tendency to try to read more into it than we should, yeah? Sometimes it is just an editorial slip-up and we shouldn't be making too much of a big deal. That's not to say that we should be necessarily dismissing it, because, yeah, of course, there may be a profounder meaning that we're not aware of, and that often happens as well. You know, we read a text that doesn't make sense at first, but then when we look at it more deeply, it starts to make sense. So we shouldn't kind of dismiss things too lightly because of that. But we just need to try and hold that middle ground where you're sort of neither accepting nor rejecting, but just trying to understand it. And after a while you kind of get a sense for what kinds of things are likely to be a reciter's error, what kinds of things are likely to be a sort of an intentional statement. So just my suspicion is that formulation in this place is more likely to be just a reciter's error rather than anything requiring sort of deeper analysis. No, but yes, that's what he is saying. Yeah.
So you're saying it could just be reciters.
No. I'm saying that the fact that he says don't let your consciousness be dependent on consciousness is likely to be a reciter's error. That probably comes from mechanically applying that same phrase in those other places. Whereas in fact what it probably simply said was don't let your consciousness be dependent on the eye or the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body or the mind. Yeah, rather than don't let consciousness be dependent on consciousness.
Is this be like four elements came to six elements?
Exactly. Exactly, yeah.
So four elements could have been to six elements. It's originally like consciousness in the air.
Yeah.
Five elements, I said, probably five, good measure.
Yeah. Yeah, so those things again, it's very, very easy to see how that they get expanded.
Consciousness is not in Mama Rupa. Maybe it was always seen with Mama Rupa rather than
I don't know. It doesn't say that, but
just quickly, what are the whole six elements?
Earth. So you know we got that one? That's the kind
of
dirt, water, stuff you swim in, air, the stuff you breathe,
yeah.
Fire, the stuff in the metal box downstairs, yeah. Space, right? The stuff between your ears.
That was almost due.
That's good, that's good. Yeah. And consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. The real stuff that's actually between your ears. Yeah.
I don't think we've gone over there.
Sorry?
I don't think we've gone over there. I don't think.
Six elements?
We've never gone over there in any class.
Yeah, well,
I'm
not sure what to say about them, but I mean, the main thing from a Buddhist point of view to notice is that with the element of space is always dependent on the other, so it doesn't really exist independently. No, I won't go into too much detail in the elements, but anyway, moving along. Okay, so back to the sutta and to Anathapindika's response. Having just been told not to get attached to anything, he burst into tears. The Venerable Ananda said to him, so obviously it's not just Sariputta there, so obviously when the crying...
As
the attendant, right. So when the crying starts, of course this is Ananda's territory, not Sariputta. Sariputta's sitting there thinking, oh my god. Pull it together, man. Ananda's almost in tears himself. Venerable Ananda asked him, are you foundering, householder? Are you sinking? I'm not foundering, Venerable Ananda. I'm not sinking. But though I have long waited upon the teacher and the bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such talk on the Dhamma. And Ananda said, or Sariputta says, or someone says, anyway, Such talk on the Dhamma household is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dhamma is given to those who have gone forth. And Anathapindika says, well then, Venerable Sariputta, let such talk on the Dhamma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen with little dust in their ears who are wasting away. Oh dear. There are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk. Well, there must have been dust in their ears because they can't hear the Dhamma. It must be a misprint. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. So this exchange is quite striking. And we know that the Buddha elsewhere said that he taught the Dhamma with no inner and outer, without holding anything back. And so, you know, it seems almost a bit kind of, you know, stingy. The Buddha sort of criticized the thing of Dhamma Macharya, being stinginess with the Dhamma. And yet here it seems almost like the policy is being said to be, oh, well, we don't anything, you know, the advanced teachings, we don't give to the plebs, but only the insiders get the good stuff and you just get the crap. So Analu has a comment here. Okay, so the discourses, such discourses are not given to the laity, is found both in the Pali and the Madhyama and the Sangita Agama versions. The commentary explains the reason for this to be that lay followers do not usually like such instructions, since they live immersed in possessions and do not appreciate being instructed to give up desire and attachment to these. The identity of the speaker of this explanation is not clear. So this whoever actually said this is not clear. It could be Sariputta, it could be Ananda. Since no explicit indication is made, and the previous sentence is spoken by Ananda, while Anathapindika's reply is addressed to Sariputta. According to the Sangyukta Agama, it was Sariputta who explained to Anathapindika that for a long time he had not given such instructions to householders. So the Sangyukta Agama makes it clear it was Sariputta rather than Ananda. The Kotara Agama reports that Ananda gave a longer explanation to Anathapindika, distinguishing between two types of people. The point they made this explanation might be that teaching methods differ according to the propensity of the different individuals. And Analio actually had a more extensive discussion of this in an earlier version of this paper, and unfortunately that's omitted from the present one, but the gist of that discussion, actually, we can see if we come back to the Pali Dictionary of Proper Names, and we look here at this list of the various teachings given to Anathapindika and various places in the suttas, mostly in the Anguttara Nikaya, on the importance of having a well-guarded mind, on the benefits the recipients of food attains, the four obligations that make up the householder's duties, the four conditions of success that are hard to win, four kinds of happiness which a householder should seek, the five kinds of enjoyment which result from wealth rightfully obtained, the five kinds of things that are very desirable but difficult to attain, long life, beauty, happiness, glory, and so on, five sinful acts that justify a man's being called wicked, and the last one is somewhat interesting, the inadvisability of being satisfied with providing requisites for monks without asking oneself if one also experiences the joy that is born of ease of mind. Okay, so it's not just about offering, but also about reflecting on yourself. So obviously you have a very strong tendency here in these teachings to Anathapindika himself, to focus on the more kind of simple aspects of sort of good advice and common sense and ethics and generosity and so on and so forth, rather than the profound aspects of the Dhamma. Anathapindika, of course, himself, as we noted before, being a wealthy merchant, and that remark in the commentary, of course, being obviously true, that people don't be like being told, give up everything, and don't be attached to anything, especially people who are very wealthy and obviously do have a lot of attachment to material possessions. And, you know, and in that case, not just that, but an Atapindika, you know, as someone who's a benefactor, also attached not just to the possessions, but to his role as a benefactor, one would presume. So, Analia also points out in the discussion, the earlier discussion, and I think it's unfortunate that he's taken that one out, so I think he's somewhat abbreviated some of these chapters, but he noted that there are actually many other places in the suttas where you do in fact find quite profound teachings being given to lay people, and where the Buddha, for example, advised the lay people to study the Brahmajala Sutta, is one of the most profound suttas in the Pali Canon, and many other places where deep teachings are in fact given to householders. So I don't think that this statement is meant to be taken as a sort of absolute thing, but I think I think that point that the commentary makes is actually quite a good one, that it's, if it is true that it's, these teachings are less often given to lay people, it's not out of a sense of not wanting to teach them the more profound aspects of the Dhamma, but it's about what people are interested in hearing. And so most times the lay people are interested in hearing the more simple Dhammas and are not so... not so enthusiastic about being told that they should let go of everything. And anybody who's done any teaching for lay people will know that that's obviously the case, and it's perfectly understandable. It's just you teach for whatever people are interested to hear. Don't force them on them things that are not.
Yeah, but what did the Buddha teach him in the first meeting?
I think it was just about the. It was probably. I think if I remember correctly, it might have been there's a stock passage on teaching of giving and virtue and so on, and then. But then and then it goes up to the Four Noble Truths. So yeah. I think that's the case. I think it's that stock teaching. Yeah. And that particular stock teaching is actually interesting because that's somewhere that you find many times that in the, it's abbreviated many times in the Vinaya and other places. You know, you're familiar with the passage I'm talking about. He spoke about generosity and virtue and the advantages of giving up and the dangers of attachment and so on, and then up to the Four Noble Truths. And heaven and hell and so on, yeah.
It's
gradual teaching. And it's fascinating that teaching is summarized in many places, but there's nowhere in anywhere in any of the schools or any of the traditions where that's actually spelled out in detail. Not the same. I mean, all of the parts of it are, but not the whole thing as a whole. Not the whole thing, yeah. Each individual section, yes. But there's no one place where all of that, all of those are spelled out in detail.
But it's very reasonable to think in that manner.
Sure, yeah.
It depends on the understanding of the Rishikra.
Yeah.
I remember in some, one of the men who used to come to Ajivata, Bhakya Vocha.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that man?
Yes, of course. How could I forget?
At first, when he comes to Ajivata, the water speaks in different manner, and a few years later, he speaks in another different.
Yeah.
And 10 years later, he speak in another way.
Mm.
And 20 years later, he speak in a way that man cannot send you another way. So it is relevant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Relevant. It depends on the level of understanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
In this particular, it certainly seems quite reasonable if someone is quite like someone has gone forth is willing to give up everything external.
Right.
So isn't one of them even give up that, and how they are, how actually are they going to give up the internal things as well?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but even.
I mean, the benefits of receiving food or something.
Yeah.
A little bit more than that.
Yeah, but you know, it really just depends on different people's character. Maybe he just wasn't very, you know, sometimes people are just not interested in those kinds of things, you know. It very much is dependent on people's personalities. Yeah, I mean, there are some people who, you know, just, you know, they just like to ask you these questions about dependent origination and all that kind of thing and so on. And then there are other people who maybe go to the Buddhist center for their whole lives and just are very happy to come and serve.
But you're saying it's because they weren't ready to give things up. Do you think it's true that you're, you know...
But even so, it's just a personality type.
Yeah.
You know, he maybe
well,
has...
Okay. Then I guess it would be a personality. That's different.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's because lay people find it too hard to give things up.
But that's not saying as an absolute, but just as a generalization,
right.
That you know they tend to be, you know, tend to be more of an interest in, you know, living a good and a happy life in that situation, rather than a sense of sort of, you know, complete liberation from things. But I mean there you know there clearly is that distinction in the teachings, that there are some teachings given more on a conventional level and some for the sake of the higher goals. And that's somewhat, you know, somewhat correlated with the teachings for the lay and the sangha. But you know, on the other hand, then there are plenty of teachings for the sangha which are very simple on a very basic level as well, and also, as I said, plenty of teachings for the lay people which are very advanced. So it's by no means a hard and fast distinction, but just a sort of a general tendency. So. Okay, so then after giving the household Anattapindika this advice, Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Ananda arose from their seats and departed. Soon after they left, the householder Anattapindika died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven. Then when the night was well advanced, Anattapindika, now a young god of beautiful appearance, went to the Blessed One, illuminating the whole of Jeta's grove. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and addressed the Blessed One in stanzas. O blessed is this Jeta's grove, dwelt in by the sagely Sangha, wherein resides the King of Dhamma, the font of all my happiness. See, he's the font of all this happiness. And... next font we make, we'll have to call it the King of Dhamma. By action, knowledge and Dhamma, by virtue and noble way of life, by these are mortals purified and not by lineage or wealth. Therefore, a wise person who sees what truly leads to his own good should investigate the Dhamma and purify himself with it. Sariputta has reached the peak in virtue, peace and wisdom's ways. Any bhikkhu who has gone beyond at best can only equal him. That's what the young god Anattapindika said, and the teacher approved. Then the young god Anattapindika, thinking the teacher has approved of me, paid homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he vanished at once. And then when the night had ended, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus, telling them of everything that had happened. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Surely, Venerable Sir, that young god must have been Anattapindika, for the householder Anattapindika had perfect confidence in the Venerable Sariputta." "Good, good, Ananda, you have deduced the right conclusion. That young god was Anattapindika, no one else." That's what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And so here, let's just look at the parallels. The Pali and the Chinese parallels report that Anattapindika passed away. The Pali and one of the Sanghita Agama versions say he was born in the Tusita, and the Ekotarika Agama version says he was born in the Tavatinksa heaven. Tusita is a bit kind of higher up in the heavenly hierarchy. So. No, they just happen to be there. Yeah. They're down under, they're a little lower than any of those, yeah. Yeah, the realm of the four great kings, one of them is the Gandhavas, yeah. Okay, so all of the versions have the set of stanzas. The Kotrika Agama only has the first stanza. Um, but they and the Sanyukta Agama version has some parallels to the other stanzas. They all have some stanzas, but they differ in what exactly they are. But they only have the first stanza is the only one they all have in common. According to the Akotarika Agama, the visiting Deva also informed the Buddha of his identity and scattered heavenly flowers on the Buddha as well as on Ananda and Sariputta. So this implies that Ananda was present when the Deva revealed his identity, which is a bit problematic because later on in the same discourse, this is the Akotarika Agama version, the Buddha asked Ananda who that Deva could have been and then praised Ananda for rightly inferring that it had been Anathapindika. So a bit of internal incoherence in that one, and that being quite characteristic of the Akotarika Agama. Okay, so, and just another look, minor point, but from the point of view of Buddhist epistemology is also just the last statement to Ananda is also quite interesting, of course. In Buddhism, it's believed that you can know these things, like rebirth and so on, according to your psychic powers. And so here, Ananda is coming to an understanding of who that Deva was, not by any psychic powers, but by his reasoning. And I've mentioned, and this is mainly of those who've been interested in the philosophy classes and so on, and I've mentioned that in Buddhism we have like these two two forms of knowledge, one being direct vision, is pachaka, and the other one being insight or inference or anumana. And so here Ananda uses a form of anumana, a form of inference, saying that, well, because Anathapindika was greatly faithful in Sariputta, then the fact that he gave these verses in praise, the Deva gave these verses in praise of Sariputta implies that the Deva was none other than Anathapindika, and the Buddha praises him for that. Yavatakang saying, Buddha's words of praise saying, sadhu, sadhu, ananda, yavatakang, ko ananda, takaya patabang. So, as far as by reason, what by reason is to be attained, or what is to be reached by reason, that has been reached by you. That's the literal translation, of those words, which are translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as, you have deduced the right conclusion. So literally what the Buddha says is, what can be reached by reason, you have reached it, or that has been reached by you. Takaya patabang. Yeah. Yeah, by taka. Yeah, by taka, by reason. So and you know, it's just a little point, but it's just sort of worth noting that you know that the Buddha isn't, you know, criticizing or anything, he's praising Ananda for his you know, proper use of inference in that case.
Maybe that's why he didn't go to the Buddha, but he liked him.
Well, yeah, obviously, yeah, he liked him, yeah. Maybe it's just personal, maybe. But still, I mean, I still find it a little bit odd. I mean, even if he liked Sariputta, surely he'd like the Buddha more, I don't know. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, Buddha quite possibly could have been occupied. But even then, I mean, surely, you know, when the kind of the chief lay disciple died, it's hard to imagine what else he would have occupied with that was more important.
But maybe he's so humble that, you know,
yeah. Probably more likely, yeah. Yeah, so I guess so.
Maybe Buddha would have already been over 2004.
Also quite possible, yeah. Yeah, it could have been in other visits that we haven't heard of. So, what do you expect? So after that ending, the Majjhima Nikaya and one of the two Sanyukta Agama versions end there. The other Sanyukta Agama version adds a stanza spoken by the Buddha in praise of Sariputta. Whereas according to the Akotarika Agama account, the Buddha delivered a long prose passage in praise of Ananda. Okay, so that's the Anattapindika Vada Sutta. So since we have some time before 6 o'clock, and since next sutta is not all that long, how about we do the Channu Vada Sutta as well? Yeah?